was Mama Monster. That's how stupid. I can't help it.
This. I'm gonna keep the recording until you say it. So.
Okay, wait a minute. I gotta compose.
You've gotta get through it, or we're never gonna be able to do this.
I have to compose myself. Wait a minute.
Jesus. But no, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
I love you.
I love you,
you
too.
You are the best.
Thank you very
now,
much.
Now get out of here. I have a show to do.
Hey, this is Mama Monster, and you're listening to the Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Years ago this past week, the WWF got the F out and became WWE. It's like two completely different eras. One ended and a new one began. The World Wildlife Fund, they took Vince McMahon to court in the UK, claiming that his company had violated an agreement that they had reached years earlier over the use of the WWF initials, which the Panda people had first. And they did, WWF, Vince's company, they violated that agreement repeatedly over the years. So the court ruled against McMahon. He appealed the decision until one day in 2002, when the company decided to drop the appeal and just go ahead and change the name of the company. I remember for years, all those old logos that they had to blur, all the scratch logos. Hulk Hogan is recognized as the last WWF champion and the first WWE champion. Also 20 years ago was a little episode called The Plane Ride from Hell. But you have already heard me talk about that. What a week! This is episode 755 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 8th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. Wishing all the moms out there a very happy Mother's Day today. Don't forget to call your mom. WrestleMania Backlash is tonight, and I've got predictions. I've got an update on tickets for the Forbidden Door and a reaction to it. Oh my God. The brackets finally revealed for the men's and women's Owen Hart Cup tournaments. Tessa Blanchard nukes another one. And a major update on the train wreck that is Tammy Sitch. If you want to drop a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link. You'll see that text right there at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I love to show some love and appreciation at the beginning of every show for our PayPal producers, including awesome Anthony Anguiano. I want to thank him first for the kind words. And he wants to wish a very happy Mother's Day to his mom, Elise, who, of course, he loves with all his heart, and he wants to wish a happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. And so I will also wish a very happy Mother's Day to Elise. The birthday boy, Joshua Epps, who is celebrating his 20th birthday. Happy birthday, Josh. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar. James Hollywood Herrera. Is James going to leave us for Hollywood one day, like Roman Reigns apparently is primed to leave WWE soon for Hollywood? James would never leave us, right? James would never leave the show. Big B, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Billy Hardcore Habibi, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious, Alan Carter, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Shin Superkick Akuma, and Iowan Corn Farmer Jesse Lampier. Thank you all for your support this week. The match of the week was not from WWE. It was not from AEW. It was from Impact. I saw the Tomohiro Ishii match because I saw that he was challenging Josh Alexander for the Impact World title at their Under Siege show last night, and I tuned in to watch it, and they tore it up in there. A fantastic match with Alexander retaining the title. I hope they have a good opponent in mind for Ishii at the Forbidden Door next month. Samoa Joe would be a fine choice. I just put that out there into the universe. Ishii and Joe at the Forbidden Door. But I want to give Impact their flowers for at least that main event. I didn't see the entire card, but at least that main event last night because they had an excellent match. Now, WrestleMania Backlash is tonight from Providence, Rhode Island, with four WrestleMania rematches, which is typically what Backlash is, hence the name, and a canceled tag team title unification, or was it canceled? We'll get to that. But that was turned into a six-man tag. This basically is a special Peacock episode of Raw. That's what this show is. Raw's streak of good television ended at 1 week, so we can reset the counter back to zero. More than half the show on Monday involved talent not currently scheduled for the pay-per-view tonight, including the main event, which I thought was a pretty good six-woman tag. They had Bianca Belair, Asuka, Liv Morgan, taking on Becky Lynch, Rhea Ripley, and Sonya Deville. Liv Morgan got a rare win. They gave her a rare victory in that match. And I thought it was fine for a TV main event, but it was curious that they would end the show with it. They would go off the air with that match, given that not a single one of the women involved has a match tonight. In fact, none of the Raw women are on this show, barring any late additions to the card. We don't know what the kickoff match is going to be. It's still very possible, you know, after I'm done recording here, they'll add one match. But as of... it's just crazy to me. As of this moment, that was the focus of the end of the show on Monday, and not a single one of them are on the card right now. Happy Corbin takes on Madcap Moss in a battle that I am sure will rival the greatest wrestling match ever at Backlash 2 years ago with Edge and Randy Orton. I'm sure it'll rival that classic between Stone Cold and The Rock in the main event of the very first Backlash. Moss is the new guy. They're trying to get him over. He should win. I think Corbin wins. He's my pick because they are going to want to extend this feud for another month, because why wouldn't they? I think they enjoy torturing me. I don't think this is the end of this. So I think Corbin picks up the win. Bobby Lashley against Omos. Speaking of torture, Omos has MVP in his corner for the first time here in a big match. There's no way he loses here. But yeah, the thing about the Omos push, it cannot be sustained for more than a few months. So whatever mileage they're going to get out of him is going to come over these next, I'd say, 6 months or so. And so long as Roman Reigns is the champion and he's the heel champion, there's only so much you can do with him as the monster heel. He's not going to be stepping in there against Roman Reigns. Now, maybe if Roman finally drops the titles in the next few months and he drops it to someone like Drew McIntyre, could we have a pay-per-view main event later in the year between Drew McIntyre and Omos? I mean, that sounds fucking terrible. But this is a very finite window that they have with this guy. This will not last, but he's the one getting the push right now, not Bobby Lashley. So I would mark this down as an Omos win. AJ Styles seeks revenge against Edge. This was one of the matches I was most looking forward to at this year's WrestleMania. They had a very good match, but they could do better. And I'm hoping that's what we get here tonight. Damian Priest is banned from ringside after losing his match to AJ on Raw Monday night, but they never said anything about Finn Balor being banned from showing up. Balor came to AJ's rescue on Raw after he was being attacked 2-on-1 after the match. Little Bullet Club love being shown between the two of them. They gave each other the too sweet. They hugged. Priest may not be able to help Edge this time, but that doesn't mean Balor can't help AJ, which would lead to a Styles win. Now, Edge and AJ, they're one win apiece. We get the tag team match on TV with Styles and Balor against Edge and Priest. I think they hold off on the reveal of a third member of Judgment Day, either for TV or maybe Hell in a Cell next month. My money is still on Rhea Ripley. I absolutely think that she should link up with this group. And I know there's been a lot of speculation online about Finn Balor. Is he going to turn heel? Is he going to do a big swerve? Is he going to join with Edge and Damian Priest at Judgment Day? You know, he can't go any lower than he is right now. If they've been beating him like a drum with the idea that it doesn't matter because we're going to turn him heel and it'll be a clean slate for him, then that could be a fresh start for him. I'm not against the idea. I'm not sold that it's necessarily going to happen tonight. So I'm going to stick with AJ as my prediction. We have Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins. They're going to go at it at least one more time. Cody has been on a roll since coming back. He's going to run into a few roadblocks along the way on his journey to the eventual championship match that he's going to get. But I don't think Seth Rollins should be one of those roadblocks. Especially since the story is that Seth Rollins feels like the only reason he lost at WrestleMania is because he was unprepared. He didn't know who his opponent was going to be. He was flying blind. This time he's coming into the match fully aware of who his opponent is going to be. And if he wins, Rollins is basically proven right that Cody's win at WrestleMania was nothing more than a fluke. They had one final segment in the ring together on Monday where Cody could see that he was unraveling and, yeah, he put Rollins over as one of the best of the last 20 years, but he also called him delusional. And Rollins brought up his father and he said that Dusty was delusional, just like Cody is. He said Dusty wanted to be WWE champion, but he just wasn't good enough. And as long as I'm here, Cody's not going to be good enough either. And Rollins took a swing at him. Cody came back with a Cody cutter. And that was their final interaction. This should be another win for Cody Rhodes. I'm going to go with Cody for my pick. Fully aware of the fact that they might go the 50-50 route. But I'm telling you, this should be another win for Cody Rhodes. None of this 50-50 booking bullshit. You know, Triple H put Batista over in three straight matches from WrestleMania to Backlash to Vengeance in their Hell in a Cell match. I could see this playing out the exact same way and doing one more with these two after this to really, you know, put Cody over strong. You could say, well, if Rollins loses a second time, why do a third match? Well, I mean, it's not like they haven't done this before. But Cody is the one who needs to go over strong when this is over with. The next pay-per-view they're doing is literally called Hell in a Cell. So they could follow the exact same blueprint. Cody should win this match. Charlotte Flair defends the SmackDown Women's Championship against Ronda Rousey in an I Quit match. I think there's a good chance this match closes the show. Especially if Ronda is going to win the title, which I believe she is. Ronda Rousey is my pick. I think she's going to walk out the new SmackDown Women's Champion. No mention of Drew Gulak being involved in this at all. I mention him because he's been involved in these different segments with Charlotte over the last several weeks. You would think it was leading to something. And there was no mention of him at all connected to this on Friday night. They had one last segment, a big pull-apart brawl between Charlotte and Ronda on Friday, which was the best segment that either one of them have done in this entire feud. You know, there, I mean, Charlotte came out, she was talking and cutting a promo, but once that ended, it was just this big pull-apart. But they did the Beat the Clock gimmick last week, Ronda won. She got nothing out of it, she won. Beat the Clock. Who cares? Most of what they've done here has sucked on television. The promos have sucked. The Beat the Clock thing was pointless. It's like they ran out of gas trying to figure out what they can do to heat this thing up. Well, you could always go to the tried and true pull-apart brawl, which is what they did on Friday. But this feud has been channel-changing for me. There's been nothing appealing about any of this. And I cannot wait for this to be over and for them to move on. And maybe they can still add Gulak as their, because my whole thing was if Gulak has been getting abused by Charlotte and run down by her on the, which again, she was on Friday. She mentioned Gulak in her promo, blamed him for why she lost the Beat the Clock challenge. We've seen Gulak playing multiple roles over the last several weeks. He was a ring announcer, or not a ring announcer, he was a timekeeper. He was an interviewer. He was a lackey for Adam Pearce. Why wouldn't Adam Pearce give him a tryout as a referee? That could play into Ronda's win, and then Charlotte would have an out. She can blame Drew Gulak for why she lost the championship. Maybe he'll be inserted on the pay-per-view tonight. But Ronda Rousey is not going to say, I quit. She loses this match at some kind of, you know, bullshit finish. You know, remember Rock and Mankind from the Royal Rumble? It would have to be something like that. I don't see that happening. I don't see Ronda losing back-to-back. So she's my pick to win. And then we have Roman Reigns teaming up with the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, the Usos, to take on Drew McIntyre and the Raw Tag Team Champions, Randy Orton and Matt Riddle. Now, according to Meltzer in this week's Observer, the six-man tag was always the planned match for Backlash. There was never any plan for an actual tag team title unification. If that is true, if you take that at face value, and I don't necessarily, but if you take that at face value, now they're just blatantly lying to their fans and they're getting their hopes up for something they never seriously intended to follow through on. You know, when they started dropping little teases after day one, when Brock Lesnar stepped in, when, you know, Roman went down with COVID, they put the WWE title on Brock Lesnar. And earlier in the year, while he was the champion, there were teases on television, mentions on television, not just speculation on social media by internet fans, that Brock Lesnar wanted Roman Reigns in a winner-take-all unification match. And there were a couple of teases before anything was actually announced. But eventually, we got there. They did end up giving us a winner-take-all unification at WrestleMania. Which only made sense, because why would you tease the biggest possible stipulation that you could do without following through on it? If you promise something like that and you advertise it, you need to follow through. What they've done here is they've taken a match with high stakes, and they've replaced it with a match with no stakes. Not even Omaha stakes. No stakes at all. They're giving us the inferior of the two matches. And they're treating their fans like idiots, as they often do. This is one of their favorite pastimes. Now, I don't necessarily buy the report that they planned the six-man all along. Something smells rotten in Denmark here. Because it still makes no sense. I'm going to go back to the point that I made last week. Makes no sense why Roman Reigns would send the Usos to Raw because he wants them to bring home all the gold, only to then have him be the one to rip up the contract for the match last week. It's one thing if you follow through and there's some bullshit finish and we end up not getting an actual unification, but just in terms of the storyline and how it all played out on TV, Roman Reigns is the one who wanted this in the first place. It was his order to send his cousins to the other brand and make the match happen. And he's the one out there last week ripping up the contract during the contract signing segment. What does make sense is that they planned to do the unification and then they realized they had no good opponent for Roman Reigns. And so they decided to go with the six-man idea, which would explain why Reigns was out there ripping up the contract. But since they're not adding any kind of winner-take-all, last-minute stipulation for this match, if it were me, I would have the babyfaces go over. But after what happened at the end of SmackDown, where the babyfaces got the better of the bloodline and sent them packing, this is going to be a win for the bloodline. I think Roman, Jimmy, and Jay are going over in the main event tonight. You know, one of the reasons I wanted Roman Reigns to unify the top titles was because there are so few credible challengers for him. You know, merging the titles would, at least in theory, would give them a reason to feature him in a program on Raw, not just on SmackDown. And in the first 4 weeks now, a month has gone by since WrestleMania. In the first 4 weeks after WrestleMania, that has not been the case at all. At all. If they want to save Roman Reigns against Drew McIntyre for the summer shows, they still have one more pay-per-view left before they get there, and that's Hell in a Cell on June 5th. If it's me, now I've already said I think the bloodline is winning. Okay, but now let's turn it around to what I think should happen. If it's me, I would have Randy Orton pick up the win for the babyfaces. And I would have Randy Orton pick up the win with an RKO to Roman Reigns. And he pins Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns has not been pinned on television since December of 2019, when he lost to Baron Corbin at TLC. He had a couple of disqualification losses since then, like the one to Seth Rollins at the Royal Rumble this year, but that's it. He has been kept unbelievably strong. So Orton pinning him would be enough to earn Orton the right to challenge Reigns at Hell in a Cell. And it would buy them another month before going to the Reigns and McIntyre match, either at Money in the Bank or at SummerSlam. You know, after watching SmackDown, they're back to teasing a Shinsuke Nakamura match with Roman Reigns instead. I don't go with Nakamura. If it's me, I go with Randy Orton for the next match. Even if he is one half of the tag team champions, Orton is still over. Orton will always be in the conversation when it comes to the top title. He will always be a credible, believable challenger to the top title. And it's been a while since we've seen him in that position. But there's another interesting little thing to mention about Roman Reigns. I'm sure some of you have seen the video going around since last night. After his win over Drew McIntyre at the WWE live event in Trenton, New Jersey, Roman Reigns took the microphone and he addressed the crowd. And I know there's one video going around, it's very difficult to hear what he's saying, but there was a different video, a fan shot that was a little more understandable. And part of what he said, it was a very kind of shoot from the hip type of thing, it felt like. And he said he's starting a new phase in his life. And he said, I honestly don't know if I'll be back here again in Trenton. And it wasn't a heel promo at all. He didn't have the Usos or Paul Heyman around him. It was just Roman Reigns in the ring. He wasn't saying, you know, acknowledge me and, you know, heeling on the crowd or anything like that. He thanked them at the end. They cheered him as he left. It felt like a heartfelt speech. I think Randy Orton said it best when he was on the bump a few weeks ago. We're talking about the 20th anniversary of Randy Orton in WWE. So they had him on the bump. And he brought up Roman Reigns, or Roman got brought up somehow, and he said, he goes, Roman's got Rock's agent on speed dial. He is definitely the next guy to go to Hollywood to do movies. What Rock has done, what John Cena has done, Roman Reigns is the next one to do that. This is not the first time that he has dropped a hint to us about this. On SmackDown last year, during one of his promos, he made a comment about when my days are done around here, which could be sooner than later. And it was almost like a throwaway line, but the hints have been there if you've been paying attention. You know, when this run that he is on right now comes to an end, he is going to have been champion for 600 plus days, maybe 700 or 800. He's already over 600. He may pass 700 or 800 by the time all is said and done as the champion. When that happens and he finally gets beaten, where does he go after a run like that? He can't go any higher outside of the obvious match with Rock, if they could pull that off for WrestleMania. And outside of turning him babyface and having him chase to get the belt back, but for what? He's never going to have a run like this again. You know, Hogan had his 4 years as champion. For all the time that, all the times Hogan had the title, he never had a run like that first big run as champion from 84 to 88. CM Punk had his 434 days as the champion. He was never going to get that again. Even if he would have stayed, he never would have had a run like that again. I'm not saying he's going to pack it up and retire, but when this run is over, I believe the days of Roman Reigns as a full-time performer are done. And that's very bad news for WWE. Although I could look at it two ways and say that it's both good and bad. It's bad for the obvious reason, because, look, they may have some diamonds in the rough down in NXT at the PC right now. Bron Breakker and Carmelo Hayes, and you could pick out maybe two or three, four people at the most who could maybe one day be in that spot. But Bron Breakker and them, nobody is ready to step into that spot in the next 6 months. That's down the road. They have built everything around Roman Reigns for years, even when people didn't want to see him and they were booing him and they were revolting against the babyface push. This guy's had 6 or 7 WrestleMania main events. Everything has been built, especially in this run, around Roman Reigns. And they haven't created that next obvious guy to step into his shoes when he's done. So that's the obvious why it's bad. Now, it could be a good thing, because if he does step away and becomes part-time and we don't see him as often, they can't rely on him as much, then they're going to have no choice but to look elsewhere. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but they're going to have no choice but to push other people and give other people a chance. You can't just push Roman Reigns, even if he doesn't leave. Even if he doesn't leave. And him saying this, it's part of, you know, it's a very calculated thing, and he gets Vince McMahon to back up the Brinks truck, and he gets this big fat contract, big fat raise when his contract is up, which is very smart. That could be part of the play here. Even if he gets that, and he says, you know what, I got another 5 years of a full-time run left in me. You can't build everything around one person. You have to branch out. You have to look and say, okay, we believe in this person, we believe in that person, and have two or three of those people at the top of your card that you can build around instead of just one. The same guy. You can't keep doing that. So it can be an opportunity for them, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to be painful. But the breadcrumbs are already being dropped. The signs are there. They're in big trouble if they lose him full time. That's why I think Cody Rhodes came back at the best possible time for his career. They're going to need to lean on him even more, that much more, when Roman steps away to do other things. Guys like Drew McIntyre and Cody Rhodes, they're going to have to be focused on even more. But I'm going to be live on YouTube tonight. As soon as the show is over, join me for the full review. I mean, what else are you going to do on a Sunday night? Come on. I mean, really. Here, I'm out here on New York. Come out to the coast. We'll get together. We'll have a few laughs. WWE announced its quarterly earnings on Thursday with another record quarter, $333 million in revenue through the first 3 months of this year. $66 million in profit. That is up from $263 million in revenue and $43 million in profit in the same quarter a year ago, mainly because there was no Saudi Arabia show last February, like there was this year. Each Saudi show, that brings it about $50 million alone. Live events were up $23 million from a year ago this time, but that's because they weren't running any live events a year ago at this time. So there you go. That kind of makes sense. They got a nice bump from the 2K22 game as well that was released. Nick Khan said that when WWE enters its next round of TV rights negotiations, they will have more potential buyers than they did the last time, which I don't think was ever in doubt. I'm sure that's the case. I expect they'll get even more money than they got last time. It keeps escalating every few years. I feel the same way about AEW, wherever AEW lands. I think they'll get more money as well. The only question is how much more. I don't think it's a question of will they get more. I think it's a question of how much more. How much of a bump do they get? I think WWE will get a huge bump. Only this time, those buyers might include one of the big streamers, like Apple and Amazon. You know, Thursday Night Football starts up on Amazon Prime this fall. Apple has the Friday Night Baseball games on Apple TV+. Even Dancing with the Stars. I didn't even realize that show was still on the air, but Dancing with the Stars is being moved off ABC. It's being moved onto Disney Plus next season. You know, they're trying to attract the older demographic now that they have all their kids and grandkids tied up. All the kids and the grandkids are watching Disney Plus. Now they want the older folks. But Netflix could also be a potential landing spot for them. Even though Netflix has been slashing left and right lately. I mean, they've been doing more slashing than a Michael Myers movie. They lost 200,000 subscribers in the first quarter alone. And they expect to lose even more in the current quarter. Boy, you know, if only Netflix would stop catering to the hardcore audience, they might be able to keep more of those casuals. You got to remember those casual viewers. But if they decide to throw their name in the hat, you know, for live programming, as Nick Khan believes they might, then Netflix could be a possible partner for WWE if they leave Fox and or NBC Universal when those deals are up. You know, Raw and SmackDown could end up becoming a package deal. They could be reunited on the same service or the same channel, and go to one place, if there's one place willing to offer WWE a boatload of money. Because after all, they are running a business, and you're in business to make money, right? I hear that from people all the time. It's true, right? You're in business to make money. That is the most important thing. Well, that brings me to AEW. It was all scalpers. Tony Khan and his army of bots bought them all himself. It's Chicago, the same market they always run, so of course they were going to sell out. Yeah, but you know, New Japan was responsible for maybe 500 fans max. People who bought tickets only bought them because it's AEW. Yeah, but it's all the hardcores that bought them. What about the casuals? What about the casual fan? What about them? What about Raven? Yeah, but these big shows, they're not tough to sell out at all. I mean, people are always going to go to the big shows, regardless. What do all of these things have in common? These are all of the excuses that people came up with on my timeline this week. All of the verbal diarrhea that I saw leaking into my replies. These are real things that people said to me. After AEW did exactly what I and probably a lot of other people, anybody with a brain, said they were going to do when tickets went on sale for the Forbidden Door pay-per-view. June 26th in Chicago at the United Center. I told you, they would sell that show out. It took them all of 40 minutes during the pre-sale on Thursday to sell more than 11,000 tickets, and the 3,000 they held back for the general public on sale on Friday, those were also gone instantly. That makes this the second AEW show in the last 2 months to top $1 million gate. Now, I know WWE, to them, no big deal, right? They're going to run all these stadium shows, they do $1 million gates in their sleep. But for AEW, that's a new phenomenon. And they've now done it twice, back to back. Awful Alfred from Forbes is in absolute shambles. AEW and New Japan, they just packed the largest arena in the United States. Now, I'm sure they could pack in even more if they wanted to open up more sections. The capacity for the United Center is over 20,000. Maybe not the full 20,000 plus, because some of that would be obstructed view, but WWE does the same thing. They have that gigantic LED set, and they end up tarping off multiple sections. Now, I get why they do it. I wish they wouldn't. I wish they would open up some of the sections behind the entranceway like they used to do in the early 90s. You go back and you watch some of those old WrestleManias, like WrestleMania 8 at the Hoosier Dome. They had that little aisleway with the neon WWF sign over it, but they had no screen. So you saw people behind the set. Yeah, even in the late 90s, you look at some of those pay-per-views. During the whole Monday Night War period, Bad Blood in 97, the Royal Rumble in 98, a lot of those shows, even in 97, you know, even in the Raw's War era with the Titantron, the pay-per-views back then, they didn't have the screens like they had the screens on TV. Eventually they did. I always liked the visual of fans behind the entrance, but I get that those days are not going to be coming back. You know, maybe if they still put money into those creative set pieces, I wouldn't mind it so much, but they don't even bother to do that anymore. But I do want to mention one thing, because as positive as it was for AEW to, you know, sell out their allotment of tickets, and that's great news, there were a lot of people who were very frustrated and very upset, because all of the focus of the on sale, especially on television, what they mentioned on television was Friday, May 6th. They were hammering home that Friday date. As far as tickets going on sale, Friday, May 6th, 11 a.m. Eastern. Friday, May 6th, 11 a.m. Eastern. With no mention of there being a pre-sale on Thursday. Meanwhile, that's when most of the tickets disappeared. All the good seats were gone. So the 3,000 or so they held back for Friday, I don't want to say they were all shitty seats, but the majority of the seats and probably all the good seats were already gone the day before. You had people saying, wait a minute, I had alarms and notifications and reminders set to wake up on Friday and set up different devices, and I was going to go on Ticketmaster and I was going to get tickets, and then they're all gone. You told me Friday and all the tickets were gone on Thursday. And a lot of people were rightly frustrated about that, and I think that is a problem. And it's not just WWE does the same thing. They always have pre-sales. So, I mean, I'm aware of that. I think most people probably are aware of that at this point, that there's always going to be a pre-sale. You got to look for the pre-sale code. But there are people who they hear the date that they're advertising on television and they think, okay, that's the day that either the tickets are going to go on sale, or even if there's a pre-sale, they'll release certain pockets of seats, but the majority of them, the good ones, will go on the day that they advertise. And that's not what happened this week. And I can understand people being upset about that. A lot of people got shut out. Or the tickets that do end up on the secondary market, and there will always be some tickets that end up on the secondary market, they're going to be marked up by a lot. So those people might still be able to go to the show, but they're going to be paying a lot more. And I understand that. I think both companies need to do a better job if they're going to be plugging these dates on television of at least letting people know, about the pre-sale stuff. But it was adorable. It was adorable watching people trying to come up with every excuse that they could think of under the sun of why this was somehow not an impressive feat. Only wrestling fans would regard a sellout as a bad thing. Ticket sales are ticket sales, regardless of who the target audience is and regardless of who's buying them. Now, of course, there is always going to be a certain number of scalpers, no different than with WWE shows and other major sporting events. If the demand is there, they will sell, just like they did for the First Dance last summer in that same building. It sucks for the fans who are going to wind up paying more for those seats, but if they sell, they sell. You can't use the argument when it comes to WWE, my God, look at, you could talk about their creative, but you're just a hater. Look at the business they're doing. They're making billions of dollars. It's all about making money. They have shareholders. They have a fiduciary responsibility. It's all about making money, right? They're in business. You're in business to make money. Well, AEW is the same thing. They're in business to make money too, and they made a lot of money this week. They sold a lot of tickets. And what's more impressive is they did it without announcing a single match. Not one attraction, not one match was announced for this card. Someone asked me if I think Tony Khan is going to run a different city for All Out in September since they're running Chicago in June. I think he's going to want to stay in Chicago, but if he does, he absolutely needs to run the United Center again. Now, if there's a scheduling conflict, then there's a scheduling conflict and he can't do it. I haven't looked at the schedule. But if he's able to, absolutely needs to run the United Center again for that show. I said this even last year. They have outgrown the Now Arena. They run the Now Arena in Hoffman Estates. It used to be the Sears Center. And I know that, it's kind of a sentimental thing. And there's some sense of loyalty to the building because it was the first place they ran there. All they're doing is limiting the amount of money that they can make that weekend if they stick with the smaller building. They've outgrown that building. I would honestly love to see them do All Out in Canada this year and finally make their way up north. They've got the Air Canada Center in Toronto, whatever it's called now. I think it has a new name. The building, not the city. Toronto is still the name, at least until it gets called up to the main roster. Then Vince McMahon will give it a different name. But for their first time up north, they absolutely would sell that building out. I believe that. Or they could run the Sky Dome. There is the Sky Dome up there in Toronto, and they could probably do a healthy... I would say if they ran the Sky Dome, I don't think they would sell it out. But I do think they could get a healthy 25 to 30,000 in that building. They could get enough people in there to make it look good. Not unlike the strategy that Nick Khan is using next year with WWE running more stadium shows. I talked about that last week. Nick Khan wants to run more stadium shows. They're already running like 8 of them this year. He wants to run even more. He wants, I think, all the pay-per-views. And then you throw in the Saudi shows and stuff. He wants even more stadium shows next year. Because the logic, they know they're not going to sell them all out. But they can get way more people into a stadium or a dome than they could some of these NBA arenas. These NBA arenas, in a lot of cases, they could fit 18 to 20,000, and WWE doesn't get 18 to 20,000 because they're blocking off sections left and right. They have this giant set. There are obstructed view seats because of that, so what do? A sellout for them would be 14,000 or 15,000. Like when they run the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Same thing. So you run the bigger buildings, you don't have to sell it out. You can make it look real good if you get 25,000 people, even if the stadium or whatever dome can fit 60,000. They can take $25,000 and make it look really good. AW can do that, baby, at the Sky Dome. So I think they'll want to stick with Chicago again, but if it were me, unless there's some logistical or scheduling reason not to do so, or visa issue with some of the talent that would prevent them from getting across the border, I would run Canada. I feel like, yeah, everyone's talking about the UK and when is AEW going to run overseas. You got a lot of wrestling fans in Canada, and they're very passionate. They're I think of the most passionate fans, wrestling fans in the world, and I think of the UK, and I think of Canada. And then here in this country, I think of certain markets like New York and Chicago, but I always think of the UK and Canada first. And part of it is they don't get the shows as often as we do. But you got a lot of wrestling fans who are waiting, they're dying for AEW to come up there. And I think All Out would make for a good event to bring up to Canada. Television ratings were not great on either side of the aisle this week. There's one thing that WWE and AEW had in common. They were both down, but they were only down behind the NBA. The NBA was just trouncing everything. Raw on Monday did one of the lowest ratings in the nearly 30-year history of the show, 1.5 million viewers. Dynamite was down to 833,000 overall for what I thought was one of the weaker shows that they've done in a very long time. AEW is getting a new show on TBS. Not an in-ring show, but a new show nonetheless. We don't have a start date for it yet, but a survey went out to some fans seeking feedback on a name for a new behind-the-scenes style AEW series that is currently in development. That sounds very similar in style to what Roads to the Top was, only this time it would be focusing on the stars of AEW trying to hold on to the titles they have and win back the ones they've lost, culminating in the biggest pay-per-view event of the year. So probably a mix between kayfabe and reality. Meltzer says it is effectively taking the place of what would have been a second season of Roads to the Top, which had already been greenlit when by Warner. Before the Warner and Discovery merger went through, and before Cody Rhodes left, they had already greenlit a second season of the show. But even though it happened before the merger, and so there's still questions about AEW's position post-merger, I look at this as a positive thing for the people who might be worried about AEW, you know, potentially being on the chopping block. You know, TBS just announced that they're no longer going to be carrying the Screen Actors Guild Awards. They've been carrying that award show since 1995. No longer. They junked CNN Plus, after one whole month, CNN Plus is now dead. Other cuts are expected, but there's no indication that AEW is in any kind of jeopardy right now. And the more that AEW works with them on new projects and new shows like this, the more valuable AEW is going to be to them. That's the key. Now, names for this new show that they're looking for feedback on, I'll just read you the list here. AEW Breakout, AEW The Climb, I'll just cut out the AEW here, Fight to the Finish, Friends and Enemies, Grit and Glory, Road to the Belt, To the Mat, To the Top, and Uprise. Of those names, I think Uprise is the one that sounds the best, that you could have a fucking pay-per-view with that name. But I said on the stream the other night, I don't like Grit and Glory, I like Guts and Glory. So that would be maybe my second choice. The other names, I could take it or leave it. But again, the point of all this, it's good news. It's a positive sign if you're an AEW fan, whether it's an in-ring show or a reality-based show or whatever it is, more of a personality-driven show. If they have more programming that is coming to one of the two major networks, that is a plus. That is something to look at and say, okay, that's a positive sign. If you're worried about where AEW might fall with all these cuts that are going on. We have more details about the first AEW video game. Evil Uno was hosting a Twitch stream on Wednesday. He confirmed the game will be called AEW Fight Forever, as Tony Khan said last month, and that the game will be available on PC. In addition to all the major consoles, they showed in-game footage, very brief, but in-game gameplay footage of Chris Statlander wrestling Nyla Rose. you know, what I saw was okay. It looks unfinished. Again, the game is not completely finished yet. So it doesn't look necessarily as polished as what you would see on 2K22, not even close. But what little I saw, I thought looked fine. I need to see more. I mean, how much are you going to get at it? Literally, it was 15 seconds, 20 seconds at the most. But per Fightful Select, roster size is going to be right around 50. And there will be some notable omissions in this first release. AEW's roster right now has a hell of a lot more than 50. They've got more than double that. I wouldn't be surprised if they had triple that under contract. DLC has been discussed. That's downloadable content. WWE has the same thing, so they could add characters over time, but nothing is confirmed. Names expected for the game include Owen Hart, Sting, CM Punk, Bryan Danielson, Adam Cole, and Ruby Soho. So it sounds like for sure those will be some of the names in the game. The Owen Hart thing I thought was pretty much well known. I mean, it was mentioned at the time that the agreement was reached with, you know, Owen's widow and the foundation that he would have some kind of involvement in the game. I mean, if not as a character, then what the hell else would Owen Hart have to do with an AEW video game? And they also report there's still lots of polishing that is needed, especially when it comes to character models and online play. And that's kind of the point. I know there's been a discussion that the game could be out as early as September. I would be surprised, frankly, if this game came out in September, but even September, the game is still not done yet. We still haven't seen a finished product. So you can only judge so much without seeing a full match or going hands-on with it yourself. Now, the website Sports Gamers Online, which broke a story last August about the relationship between WWE and 2K being seriously strained, posted a report on the same day that the new gameplay footage dropped of the AEW game, claiming that AEW and Ukes, who is developing the game, have been butting heads over it. More specifically, there have been issues between Ukes and Kenny Omega, with Omega finding himself frustrated and hating working with Ukes. And the report goes on to say, there have been multiple instances of arguments over the game's direction as well as constraints on development. The game is way over budget and has even required extra investment, but the specific amount was not mentioned. These budget issues have led to a number of features of the game either being less than originally planned or cut altogether. One of the larger impacts of the budget is the roster size, and they said that they were able to confirm the 50 figure at launch that Fightful had mentioned. AEW does want to increase the roster size via DLC post-launch, however, before committing to a fully-fledged DLC plan, Ukes is pushing for a long-term agreement for future game development, which is something AEW is not ready to commit to. Because of how things have gone during development, there are some on both sides of the fence believing this may be a one-and-done arrangement between AEW and Ukes. Fightful said that with all the time off that Omega has had, he's had time to help out with the game, but you know, he's never done game development before. I know he's a gamer, but he's not, you know, it's one thing to be a gamer and play games. It's another thing to be a game developer and all that I'm sure goes into that. So beyond some consulting, I'm not sure exactly what he's been contributing outside of ideas that he might have and giving feedback on things that they're doing. I don't know beyond that what involvement Omega would have in any of this. Now, Kenny has not commented on any of this to confirm or deny it. This is the sort of thing I would think if it wasn't true, he would squash it right away. And the fact that he hasn't, I think, says something. But, you know, Tony Khan has millions of dollars of his own money invested in this game. In the past, he's put it 8 figures worth of his own money when he has been asked about this in the past. He needs this game to be a success so they can make that money back. They cannot half-ass this. I don't know what features may have been cut if this report is accurate, but some form of creator wrestler mode I think is a must in a game like this. I do think people need to temper their expectations, though. If they're comparing this to 2K22 or any of the WWE games, those games are way more detailed than I expect the AEW game to be. This is only their first I'm already playing as downloadable AEW characters on 2K22. I've downloaded the AEW Dynamite Arena that somebody made. Some of these community creations are amazing, the work that people put into this stuff. The problem I've had is I downloaded the AEW Dynamite Arena and I haven't been able to select it. It won't let me select the arena when I do basic play mode. So I think that may be only usable in like my GM mode or something. I don't know. But hopefully it doesn't turn out to be more fun playing as Sting and Darby Allin in 2K22 than it is in the actual AEW game. You know, visuals are important, graphics are important, but a lot of it I think comes down to, and this is me talking personally, I think a lot of it comes down to gameplay and the controls. If it's easy for people to play and the game is fun, that is the most important thing. If you have a game that just isn't fun, these controls suck, it's just, it's frustrating and it's not fun to play the game, people aren't going to want to play the game. I think that's more important than anything else. And this was too good not to mention. While we're on the subject of AEW, I got to bring this up. Eric Bischoff. Eric Bischoff has been very hard on Tony Khan in recent weeks and in recent months about AEW and his view not growing its audience. And he even flat out said on his podcast that Tony probably thinks he's a pain in the ass and he's not going to invite him back on Dynamite and that makes him sad. He makes it sound like he's been unofficially banned. Bischoff made a few appearances on AEW television. He has not been used in a while. And I think what happened, and this is just my view on things, I think Bischoff started to get really testy about people making comparisons between WCW and AEW. And Tony Khan may have even in the past made certain comparisons between the two products. And there were things said, like on social media by people comparing the two. Oh, it's just like when Nitro and there were some ridiculous comments that were made, I will say. And if I were Bischoff, I can understand if he was frustrated or if he thought some of the comments were just completely ridiculous that people were making. I think what happened is he heard these comments and he took it personally and he thought it was laughable. And it's very possible Tony Khan wasn't happy with some of the comments that he made, and he chose not to invite him back. You know, as we've seen before, some of these people, they don't have very thick skin. But ever since then, I mean, you would think that Tony Khan slayed the man's firstborn the way that Bischoff has been mouthing off and going after AEW. But he won't let go of this idea that their television audience hasn't grown at all. Last month, he started a second podcast called Strictly Business, where he looks at wrestling from a business perspective. On his most recent episode, or the one from last week, he brought on a man, I believe it's either Mick or Mike Pandit, who works as a business affairs manager for NBC Universal, which has a relationship with WWE. And he's also an attorney, he's a former independent wrestler himself, so this guy's done it all. As I said, Bischoff has been talking nonstop about how AEW's audience has flatlined at around 1 million viewers a week, and it's been even less than that the last couple of weeks. But it's flatlined at about 1 million viewers a week, and they're not growing, and how bad this is. So he brings this guy on. Not a doubt in my mind, he expected him to echo the same point that he's been making, and back him up on what he's been saying. But in fact, he did the opposite. And Pandit talked about how AEW actually benefits from having the viewership, the consistent viewership that it has every week, and how it's a positive for them for a potential future streaming deal. And I want to give credit to Wrestling Inc. here for the transcription here for this part. He said, I think that is a huge advantage for them. This is not revealing anything internal, but NBC Universal executives have been very clear with how pleased they are with the WWE's drive of subscribers to the Peacock platform. Part of the advantage for WWE is that there are new events every month, yes, but then two, arguably three or four times a year, they have these big events, your WrestleManias, the upcoming Super Show in UK, Saudi events, that drive consumers who might not have been subscribed to say, hey, I have to watch this. They're loyal, they want to see new content. Is a baseline of 1 million viewers something Tony can sell as an advantage for him? Yes. The question is, what is the price that he's going to get for that? Does that mean AEW is going to get the kind of live rights media fees that they would have gotten a couple of years ago? I don't know the answer to that, but I think the advantage for them is that even at an increase to what they're currently getting paid, which is about $40 to $45 million a year, it's still probably cheaper than scripted programming. And then he went on to talk about how their best landing spot as far as streamers go is probably HBO Max. Bischoff got played on his own podcast. You hate to see it. You hate to see it. I don't think that was the answer that he was expecting. I saw that clip and I was just waiting for the Curb Your Enthusiasm music to start playing as they zoom in on Bischoff's face. Priceless. We finally have the brackets for the men's and women's Owen Hart Cup tournaments. Owen would have turned 57 years old yesterday. On the men's side, in round one, Rey Fénix, who qualified this week with a win over Dante Martin, takes on Kyle O'Reilly. Samoa Joe will battle a mystery Joker entrant. Jeff Hardy, who qualified with a win over Bobby Fish and was moving around like he had just finished doing 10,000 Hindu squats on Wednesday, takes on Darby Allin this week. And Adam Cole battles Dax Harwood of FTR. Those last two matches will be happening on Dynamite this Wednesday. Jeff Hardy is the only man in the tournament who actually wrestled Owen Hart. But I think it would be a mistake to have him beat Darby. Hardy should be putting Allin over and sending him into the next round against Cole. The other side of the bracket, so much of it depends on who the Joker is. I think Kyle O'Reilly gets past Fénix to the semifinals. And I think whoever the Joker is beats Samoa Joe, probably with a helpful distraction by Jay Lethal and his gang to keep their feud going. Who will the Joker be? I think Miro is a possibility. He was hurt, and he's been filming either a movie or a TV show here in New York, I forget which. But judging from how they've used these Jokers in the past, it's probably another one of Tony Khan's newest signings. I'm sure he's not done signing people yet. Either Cesaro or Johnny Gargano. If it is a babyface and it's not Miro, I definitely think Kyle beats Fénix. The Joker beats Joe. And then the Joker beats Kyle in the second round to go to the finals. But without knowing who that person is, it's tough to make a prediction on who wins the entire thing. I do think the winner comes from either the Joe match or the Adam Cole match. If the Joker is Gargano, we could very well end up with a final of Adam Cole against Johnny Gargano, who had, in my opinion, the greatest championship match of all time at TakeOver in New York, all time meaning in NXT, at the TakeOver New York show 3 years ago. You know, Darby and maybe to a lesser degree Rey Fénix, they are the only two AEW originals in the entire tournament. And I don't think either of them are winning. Fénix for sure isn't winning. But I don't think Darby is winning either. Now on the women's side, the first round has Toni Storm against Jamie Hayter and Britt Baker against a mystery Joker entrant, with the winners of those two matches meeting in the next round. On the other side of the bracket, we have Ruby Soho against Riho and Red Velvet against Hikaru Shida. I think the winner of the whole thing comes out of the Toni Storm match or the Britt Baker match. And what makes the Gargano thing a little more interesting is the status of his wife, Candice LeRae, who was moved to the WWE alumni page on their website this week, appears to be gone from the company. We don't know if she has a non-compete, and if so, when that would have kicked in, when that would have started. Yeah, the NXT stars generally have a 30-day non-compete, not 90, like the main roster talents do. Maybe Tony Khan is bringing both of them in as a package deal. And Candice is the Joker in the women's tournament. Candice leaving NXT, like Dakota Kai, is not a surprise. She would have no place in this new NXT. She would have felt out of place. She's got no place on the main roster. She did just have a child less than 3 months ago, so the turnaround might be a little unrealistic. Not impossible, but probably unrealistic. But I think the Joker ends up being either Candice or Athena. I mean, it wouldn't be ideal for someone like Athena to come in and debut and then lose in the first round, but if she beats Britt, you know, Britt's got a ready-made feud coming out of the pay-per-view. or I guess, you know, whatever week they do the match. The only matches actually happening at Double or Nothing are the finals. But coming out of that loss, Britt would have a ready-made feud for her. One person we know the Joker won't be is Mia Yim, who made her return to Impact last night at their Under Siege show to confront Deonna Purrazzo. She had worked there previously as Jade. Per Fightful Select, she has signed a deal to be part of the Impact roster going forward, and so that is where Mia Yim will be spending much of her time. Now, per this week's Observer, Trios titles have already been created. It's only a matter of time before we see them on AEW television. I've been predicting Trios belts in AEW since early last year. And I was surprised they didn't happen last year, and then I think I added them to my predictions this year. And I said, this year I really mean it. We're going to get Trios titles. And I guess they didn't want to unveil them until they got Kenny Omega back. And Kenny Omega's probably still a month or two away from coming, at least a month or two away from coming back. So it's not going to be happening right away. But I guess they wanted him back so they could do Kenny and the Young Bucks as a trio. But there's so many different, you know, teams that they could have in a tournament. It is ridiculous. You know, Omega and the Bucks, Cole and Red Dragon, the Blackpool Combat Club, Death Triangle, the House of Black. You could have Jurassic Express and Christian Cage, the Dark Order, whatever permutation of the Dark Order you want to have, Best Friends, the Jericho Appreciation Society, Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz. You could put Darby and the Hardys together. Or you could do Darby and Sting and CM Punk, since we've seen them as a team before. Plenty of options. What I want to see is the Blackpool Combat Club against the House of Black. Moxley, Danielson, and Yuta against Death Triangle, that would be fine too. I mean, look, that gets Danielson in the ring with Pac. So hey, you want to do that? Sign me up. That's a battle I'd like to see. You know what else I'd like to see? I'd like to see all of you Netflix watchers out there go and sign up for ExpressVPN. That's what I'd like to see. You know, watching Netflix without using ExpressVPN, it's like listening to Hall without oats. You need Hall and oats. You need your oats. I can't imagine having one without the other. It just doesn't work. Netflix has different content libraries for every country. What we have access to here in the U.S. is very different than what you may have access to where you are. That's thousands of shows, and without a VPN, you're only getting access to a fraction of those based on where you live. Unlocking content with ExpressVPN, it's so easy your grandparents can do it. Think of all the things that your grandparents don't know how to use. Smartphones, smart watches, smart TVs. It's all too much for grandma to bear, but even she can do this. ExpressVPN lets you change your online location to spoof Netflix and other streaming services into thinking that you're in a specific country when you may never have set foot in that country a day in your life. It's like being in two places at once. I was watching Rambo the other day. Rambo! Like any warm-blooded American, but I had to watch it on Australian Netflix. What's wrong with this picture? All I did was open up the app, I selected Australia, I tapped one button to connect. And when I refreshed the page, there it was. There was John Rambo. I use ExpressVPN over other VPNs because it's got blazing fast speeds. I can stream in full HD with absolutely no buffering on every device in my house. And because they have servers in 94 different countries, most people can't even name 94 countries. And I can connect to servers in 94 different ones. That gives me access to thousands of new shows and movies. So do the smart thing, stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Don't forget to use my link so you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN absolutely free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. expressvpn.com/solomonster. And now we go from Rambo to Dumbo. Tammy Sitch was finally arrested on Friday night. But don't hit the road with the family just yet, because she's already back out on the streets. The cops were waiting for her toxicology results to come back, stemming from the auto accident that she caused in March, which led to the death of a 75-year-old man who was sitting in the car waiting at a stoplight when she plowed into him and killed him. They got a warrant at the time to test her blood since they couldn't administer a sobriety test on the scene. I mean, the woman was just involved in an accident. But they believed her to be under the influence, and to the surprise of absolutely no one, they were correct. In a press release, they said that her blood alcohol level was 0.28, 3.5 times over the legal limit while operating a motor vehicle. I don't know how she was able to even stand up straight, let alone drive a car. But according to her on Twitter, it was a seizure. Or whoever's been posting on her Twitter, it was a seizure. She had a seizure that caused the accident. Maybe her defense can be that she drank so much, the alcohol caused the seizure. But she was arrested Friday night at the Hard Rock Hotel in Daytona Beach, Florida. She was transported to the Volusia County Jail for booking. That should be the last booking she ever gets. Shout out to Don Tony. He was the first one I saw post her mugshot online. She could put together an entire scrapbook with all the different ones that she's had taken over the years. And of all the mugshots that she's ever had taken, this one, the one for killing someone, is the one where she's cracking a smile. She's been hit with a total of 9 charges, including DUI manslaughter, driving with a suspended or revoked license causing death or serious injury, and 7 counts of DUI causing damage to a person or property. And prosecutors intend to pursue the DUI manslaughter charge as a second-degree felony. That she recklessly caused the death of another human being. Not that she necessarily went out that night expecting to or planning to kill somebody, but she clearly got herself sauced, got behind the wheel, and she recklessly caused this man's death. If she's convicted, she's facing a very long time behind bars. Doesn't mean that she'll get the maximum sentence, but she should. And don't forget, and I do think they should throw the max at her. They should throw the fucking book at her. But don't forget, she still has other charges pending against her in the state of New Jersey. If she gets convicted in Florida, that doesn't mean those other charges just magically go away. She also faces up to $10,000 in fines. The bond amount she was being held on was around $227,000. And she bonded out the very next day after her court appearance. A bail bondsman posted a surety bond for her. I'm sure whatever was paid was nowhere close to that total amount, but exactly how much it was, I don't claim to know. What I do know is that it means this menace is once again free to roam the streets and get behind the wheel, even though she's had her license suspended or revoked and should not be driving. She also has a civil suit pending against her and her boyfriend by the estate of the man that she killed, alleging negligence on their part. You know, the laws are what the laws are. I went over this last time because I have a lot of the same questions that you probably do. When I hear this and I hear about this story, how is it that this woman, after all of the offenses and the fact that she was caught driving without a valid license, how is this woman still free? It is a flaw in the justice system that allows this sort of thing to keep happening. I hope if she has a passport that they had the legal means to take it away from her so she can't flee. She clearly has the financial means to do so with the money she rakes in from her OnlyFans. This woman does not belong out on the streets. She deserves to be put under the jail at this point. She has squandered every chance that has ever been given to her. More chances than most people would get. And the minute that she took the life of an innocent person, which was completely predictable and preventable, the minute she did that and then went on social media to play victim and made it all about herself, that told me everything I needed to know about what a despicable human being this woman is. If Dark Side of the Ring is hard up for content, because apparently they are going to be having a 4th season at some point, if they need content, they could do an entire season on Tammy alone. The rise and fall of Tammy Sitch. Think of the absurdity of this. She still has a separate court date later this month on May 26th. She is due back in court in New Jersey from her arrest in February on 11 charges. That brings the total number of charges against her in the last few months, pending against her across two different states, to 20. 20 different charges. 11 in New Jersey and now another 9 in Florida. It's no wonder she never feels any kind of accountability for her actions. She thinks she's bulletproof. And I know that she spent a year in prison and she spent another year, I think it was, or almost a year, in a correctional facility. She has spent some time locked up. Clearly, it did not leave any kind of an impression on this woman. She doesn't seem to care. Which would explain why she was smiling in her mugshot. I mean, you talk about an evil human being. You look at that mugshot, I mean, that just reeks of evil. Reality for her may not have set in yet, that she is in a world of trouble. And when it does, if it finally does, if it ever does, that's what scares me even more about her being let out. If she feels, last time that this happened, when the accident happened in March, I had people who tweeted me and wrote into me and say, oh my God, you just predicted this a month ago. Because when she was arrested the month before, I did a whole segment out on the show and I posted it on YouTube. And people were saying, oh my God, I was just listening to your clip last week when you made the comment about being worried that she's going to kill somebody. Is that what it's going to take for her to finally wake up and realize the error of her ways? And the answer is no, clearly. But to me, it was just common sense that if she keeps being let go, even if it's only temporary because the investigation is ongoing, or charges are pending, and the wheels of justice, as we know, turn very slowly, still, she was doing these different things and was being let out and was living her life. And so in her mind, there's no accountability there. She can just keep doing what she's doing. And that was my fear. At some point, she's going to do what she's doing and somebody else is going to pay a price for it. Wasn't even worried so much about what she might do to herself if she was in an accident. But what if she hurts somebody else? What if she kills somebody else? What if she kills a kid, let alone a 75-year-old man? And we're right back here all over again. She's back out. She's got no restraints. She's got no influence or person in her life who can clearly talk some sense into her. You can't tie her to a radiator and lock her in the fucking closet. She's going to go out and do what she always does. And that's what scares me the most. And the other thing also is, if reality does begin to set in for her, and she feels the walls are closing in and she starts to feel desperate, or she realizes, oh shit, I'm screwed, and there ain't no getting out of this, there's no telling what this woman is liable to do. Because a woman who can't even acknowledge the fact this horrible accident happened, a person lost their life, there's no contrition. There's nothing. There's no emotion. She's just like a blank slate. Truly. I mean, I've heard, you know, a narcissistic sociopath. That's what this woman is. She is a complete narcissist. Doesn't care about anybody else but herself. What is she likely to do if she feels like the walls are closing in and she has no other options? She'll crash and burn. Literally crash and burn. I just hope it's not into somebody else. She may feel like there's nothing to lose or there's nothing left to live for. These are serious charges. This woman is in for a rude awakening. She is not as Teflon as she may think. And it's sad that it took somebody losing their life for it to happen. So she'll have her day in court. I just hope we don't hear about another tragedy in the meantime while she's out free. From one menace, we move on to a different kind of menace. Tessa Blanchard was back in the news this week. It was 2 years ago, on the eve of her becoming the first woman ever to win the Impact World Championship, that multiple female wrestlers went public with allegations of bullying and racism against her. There were alleged attitude issues that had plagued her career dating back to her independent days. Impact fired her. Months later, before her contract was about to expire, they terminated her and stripped her of the title, and there were issues there as well, and accusations that she was asked to do certain things and send in promos. This was during the beginning of the pandemic era where, you know, everything was closed and shut down, but, you know, they wanted her to send in promos and do certain things, and she wouldn't even do that. And so anyway, there were issues there, and they terminated her, and they stripped her of the championship. And she has done absolutely nothing of note since then. For someone who had the world by the balls at the time and should have been courting offers from all the major companies, the biggest companies in the world, it's very telling that WWE and AEW have wanted nothing to do with her. That's how toxic she is right now. Instead, last October, WOW, Women of Wrestling, announced a major syndication deal with ViacomCBS for their programming, of which Tessa was part. Tessa was wrestling for WOW. They got AJ Lee, right? April Mendez, they brought her in to be the face of the promotion. Tessa was going to be the top star. They were going to build everything around Tessa Blanchard. Episodes aren't scheduled to begin airing, I don't think, until the fall. It's going to be on local stations and markets around the country, not unlike the kind of deal Ring of Honor had when their show was airing on all the local Sinclair stations. So you may be able to watch it in your city, or you may not. It depends on what clearances it gets. But this would have been the biggest platform to date for Tessa Blanchard. I say would have, because it appears she may already be on the outs with them. Per Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful Select, WOW talent have claimed to Fightful that Tessa recently had a falling out with the company and her status is uncertain. WOW just had 3 days of TV tapings this week at the Globe Theater in Los Angeles, and per the website SoCal Uncensored, Tessa was not present at the Thursday tapings. I have not seen anything reported about the Friday or the Saturday tapings. It's possible she was there, but it doesn't appear that way. One source alleged to Fightful that Tessa cut a promo on wrestler Samantha Sage, who goes by the name Americana, in a class last month that saw Blanchard tear her apart, leading to many trainees speaking up. The acting classes were canceled from that point forward until further notice. One trainee was told that Blanchard would be less involved going forward, but that has not been confirmed by multiple sources. Another source indicated that Tessa is no longer in charge of training talent and that Selena Majors has been brought back to handle that role. And one former WOW star speculated that they believe Tessa is gone from the company. But again, that has not yet been confirmed. Tessa has not said anything. David McLean and the people at WOW haven't commented on this. It was teased that information regarding a major shift in plans for the promotion would be out in the coming days. So it seems like she may have cost herself another opportunity. And if so, that could be the final nail in her coffin when it comes to seeing this woman back working on U.S. television. You know, when you treat people a certain way, eventually it's going to bite you on the ass. There are still people who believe that it's all just one big conspiracy against this woman. It's like the Bill Cosby thing. I just shake my head at how naive people can be. One accusation is one thing. When you have all of these people coming out of the woodwork with stories of their own and details about things that these people have done or said, oh, no, it's a conspiracy. They're all getting together and they're putting this together, man. It's just one big conspiracy against this person for reasons that are unexplained. I guess in their mind, maybe they think that they're just jealous of her and they all decided to come together and attack this woman. I mean, multiple accusations from multiple people in the industry of which you are part indicates a pattern of behavior. You know, the wrestler who was alleged to have been spat on by Tessa and called the N-word, her name is La Rosa Negra, is on record as saying that Tessa did do those things. It happened at a show in Japan and she forgives her for. She's clearly not Tessa's biggest fan, if you go back and listen to or read the transcripts of some of those interviews, but she did say she forgives her for it. But to this day, Tessa denies that it ever happened. She doesn't ever apologize for it because it never happened. She denies that the entire thing even happened. You know, she's got the talent, third generation star with a wrestling pedigree, famous wrestling name. Only 26 years old. You look at the top women in WWE right now. Charlotte Flair is 36. Ronda Rousey is 35. Becky Lynch is 35. In AEW, Thunder Rosa is 35. Bianca Belair is 33. Britt Baker is 31. This woman is only 26. And WWE won't touch her. AEW won't touch her. Her own father works for Tony Khan, and they haven't hired her. She's wrestled exactly one match in the last 2 years. You know, I once said that she and Charlotte would headline a WrestleMania one day, the daughters of the horsewomen, it writes itself. And I thought one day in the next few years, probably within the next 4 or 5 years when I said this, there would be a WrestleMania or one night of WrestleMania, this is before the two-night WrestleMania started, we would see Charlotte Flair in a main event against Tessa Blanchard. I believe that to be true. But then she went and torpedoed her career through no one's fault but her own. If you make enough enemies and you give people a reason to not want to work with you and develop a reputation for being difficult to work with, and clearly she has built up a reputation, this is what ends up happening. Maybe AAA will take her back. She should start brushing up on her Spanish. Big E provided an update on his health on Twitter, and it's not great. He tweeted, "For those desirous of an update, my C1 apparently isn't healing optimally. I'll spend another 4 to 6 weeks in a brace in hopes that I can avoid a fusion. But don't you fret, I've got a tremendous support system, and what shall be, shall be." We should all aspire to be as positive as Big E is. There's somebody to model yourself after. Be less like Tammy Sitch and Tessa Blanchard and be more like Big E. You know, when Ridge Holland suplexed him on his head, Big E fractured his C1 vertebrae and his C6 vertebrae. The C1 being the more perilous of the two because, as he himself tweeted after the accident, he had his first doctor's appointment, and he came online and said, "Boy, I got some sobering news today. I was told that I narrowly escaped a stroke, paralysis, or death." And he said that really puts things in perspective. That's the one that's most commonly associated with instant death or paralysis, is a C1 fracture. He's lucky to have had that thick neck that he has. I'm sure that protected him. I'm sure that saved his life. You know, Dr. David Cho is a former WWE doctor, and I read an article a couple of months ago after the accident happened. He went online and wrote an article about Big E's injury, where he said that oftentimes the C1 fracture is one that, you know, it doesn't heal completely or it doesn't heal properly, and it could spell the end of his wrestling career. So hearing Big E admit that now he's being told his C1 isn't healing optimally, whatever that means, and that he may still need a spinal fusion surgery, that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence about him getting back in the ring. But as somebody who was scared to death when I saw him land on his head, I just want to see him heal up and live a normal life without being in any kind of pain. I would love to see him back in the ring so he can finish his career the way that he wants to and not be forced out due to injury. But to me, his wrestling career is secondary to all those other things. You know, there are plenty of other things that he could do in wrestling and outside of wrestling. But even in wrestling, if he can't get cleared to wrestle again. So, you know, he's charismatic and he can talk and he's just a fun guy. I hate seeing bad things happen to good people. I hope he can come back. But it's possible we have seen the last of the New Day in the ring as a trio. I just hope he can avoid surgery. NXT held its spring breakin' show on Tuesday. One man who has been trying to break out of NXT is Roderick Strong. That is according to a report on Fightful Select this week that claims that Roddy has asked for his WWE release multiple times over the last several months, and that he has grown frustrated with a lot of things over the past year within the company, but so far, WWE has denied his requests. They have pulled an Ali on him, and they have said no. His contract is said to have a couple of years left on it, which makes sense, because I think it was Sean Ross Sapp who reported in December that Roddy had re-signed earlier in the year. I think what was happening is people were tweeting at Sean and talking about, this would have been around the time that Kyle O'Reilly either had just debuted in AEW or he was rumored to about to be debut in AEW. And obviously he did, and he's paired off with Bobby Fish and Adam Cole. And so you have three out of the four members of Undisputed Era reunited in AEW. And I think somebody asked him about Roddy, and that's when he said, well, Roddy re-signed with the company earlier this year, that being last year. And think about what, now before people jump on Roddy, because it'd be easy to say, well, it's his own fault. Damn it, if he re-signed, then he has nobody to blame but himself. But think about what has happened since then. Let's say Roddy re-signed with WWE a year ago this month. Think about everything that has happened since then. His wife was fired in June. They fired one of his fellow Undisputed Era members, Bobby Fish, in August. And the other two members of the group turned down new contracts and they left for AEW. Adam Cole debuted in September for them at All Out. Kyle followed in December. His wife ended up working for AEW. Then WWE went and blew up and rebooted the entire NXT brand that he was part of. Of course he wants to leave. Why wouldn't he want to leave? At the time, he probably thought there was no reason to leave. All of his friends were there. Triple H was still running the show. It was still the Black and Gold. He was part of this group, this dominant faction. You know, when this Diamond Mine group was originally conceived, the original report, the idea was his wife, Marina Shafir, would be in the group with him. Malcolm Bivens would be the mouthpiece. Hideki Suzuki would be the trainer. He was the one that never wrestled and never spoke, but he was always in the background. They had Tyler Rust in the group. Remember him? Today, Roddy is the only member of that original group that's left. They fired Rust almost right away. He was part of the group for like 2 weeks. They fired Suzuki. And Bivens put his fingers in the air when they offered him a new deal and said, peace out. And he vanished like that kid in the meme. He just disappeared. He teleported. He wanted no part of it anymore. So now Roddy is assuming the role that Bivens had on TV, which is really not the role for him because he is not a great promo. He's not a great actor. He's not a great promo. And they're already teasing a breakup with him and the Creed brothers. So it looks like Diamond Mine's days are numbered. Their days were numbered the minute they let go of Bivens last week. When Bivens didn't want to stay and they cut him and let him go, that was the beginning of the end for Diamond Mine. The belief is that the company doesn't want to let him go because he's factored into creative plans. There are no plans. The plan is to break up Diamond Mine. That's the creative plan. There'll be this ongoing, slow-moving breakup. Maybe he feuds briefly with the Creeds, and that's going to be it. Those are their plans. That's the extent of their big plans for Roderick Strong. Beyond that, they have no plans. And they definitely have no plans for him on the main roster. But I knew that the moment they signed him. Roddy was never going to be given a chance on the main roster. He's too plain Jane for them. Roddy is a great wrestler. He's got a great backbreaker. His shit looks good in the ring, right? He's worked stiff, but he's had some great matches. He's a great wrestler. But on his own, he's got the personality of a bath towel. He doesn't even fit into NXT anymore. There's no place for him. It has passed him by. Unless they offer him a spot as a coach, like they apparently did with Ember Moon, I think he would make a good coach, but if he wants to wrestle, you know, he's 38 years old, I don't think he's done wrestling, then I don't see any good options for him in WWE. He's just a victim of bad timing. I feel sorry for him. If this report is true, and he really is unhappy, and he wants out, and they're saying no, and he wants to leave, in this case, because of the timing and how all of this worked out, where he apparently re-signed with them before all of these dominoes started to fall and all of these things happened one right after the other, I think he's just a victim of bad timing on when he signed that contract. You know, if his deal came up around the same time as Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly's deals, he would have held out like they did and all three of them would have ended up in AEW together. You know, now NXT, I kind of look at NXT like The Walking Dead, where all of the original characters have been killed off, save for one. Roddy is the last one alive. And maybe Cameron Grimes, you could throw him in there too. All the other actors are gone from the show. Cole is gone. O'Reilly is gone. Fish is gone. Gargano was eaten. Joe is gone. Kushida is gone. Ciampa got called up. Balor got called back up. Although I don't know why. Roddy is just begging to be eaten. So on this spring break-in show, The great theme for the show, by the way, they put some beach balls and I think beach chairs along the sides. You could barely see them. That was their big setup for this spring break show here. This is a far cry from the spring break shows WCW used to do from Club La Vila. Cameron Grimes retained his North American title over Carmelo Hayes and Solo Sikoa in a hot opener on Tuesday. You know, now that I mentioned those old WCW spring break shows, if they're not going to do anything like that on the main roster, that would have been the perfect type of thing for NXT to do. Now that they have crowds back and you know, clearly the pandemic is not a concern anymore to them, so they're already in Florida. I don't know if Club La Vila is still there or if it's open for big events or whatnot. It doesn't even have to be Club La Vila, but like the audience they're trying to appeal to, that younger demo, that younger audience, like that's the kind of show I think that would have been perfect for NXT 2.0. Outdoors somewhere like that. You got a pool right next to the ring. You have all these young people with their fucking red Solo cups and they're out there drinking and having a good time. You got all the women of NXT fucking half naked out there, which is apparently how John Laurinaitis likes it. I don't know. I think that would have been the perfect excuse for them to do a spring break type show. So they have this show, Spring Breakin', and it's in the fucking Performance Center, and they put a couple of beach balls on the side of the entrance. What a missed opportunity. But Cameron Grimes retained his North American title over Carmelo Hayes and Solo Sikoa. It's a hot opener. Those fans in the building badly wanted to see Sikoa win that championship. They sounded a little deflated, actually, when Grimes won. They don't hate him, but they like Sikoa more. He looks more impressive each time I see him. I think it's time for Carmelo Hayes, though, to, and I've said this before, I think it's time for him to move up to challenge for the NXT title after Breaker wraps up this feud with Joe Gacy. He put some shine on that North American title. He held it proudly. He held it well. He lost it. Now he's lost the rematch. It's time to bump him up. They had skits on the show. One skit where Wendy Chu turned up the dial on Mandy Rose's tanning bed. And of course she came out of the tanning bed and she was all burned. Tan lines all over her body. She looked like a tomato. Then later on, we had Wendy Chu and Roxanne Perez. Roxy, already doing comedy here on this show. They went to the beach. They were snooping around because JC Jane and Gigi Dolan went to go lay out on the beach. They were wearing these skimpy bikinis. You had me at Gigi Dolan at the beach. That's all you needed to say. But all of this supposed comedy they were doing, it wasn't really funny because they basically had Wendy Chu. They stole their shoes when they were in the water. And then they stole their car keys. So when Jane and Dolan came out of the water, they had to hop around on the hot pavement because they had no shoes. And Wendy had taken the... Now, it's not like Wendy went on a joyride in the car. And they took us along for this joyride all over Florida. It was just like, okay, we took your shoes, we took your keys, and now you're hopping around. Very funny. It wasn't funny. But all you had to say was toxic attraction at the beach. So, I mean, I'll give them a pass on that. We had a sit-down segment at a restaurant with Tony D'Angelo and his crew. The two guys whose names, I don't know what the names are, but he had AJ Galante with him. AJ Galante is he's his consigliere. And they had a sit-down with Santos Escobar and the members of Legado del Fantasma. And D'Angelo said that today, we settle things like businessmen. And Escobar said that everybody can trust me, but nobody can trust you. Everything you've done to me up to this point, the sneak attacks, the dead fish, been playing games. And Tony said, look, craps and poker and Yahtzee, those are games. I don't play games. He goes, there's plenty of pie to be split between us here in NXT. Escobar said, D'Angelo is building a family from scratch. I'm building an empire. He said that you need to follow my lead. And D'Angelo said, I don't have to listen to anybody because I'm the Don of NXT. He's the Don. Don Juan over here. Don Quixote. Escobar said that this tension is not helping anybody and Escobar would like to call a truce. And D'Angelo said that AJ Galante has advised him that peace was best for Escobar's business. They called for a toast. They toasted their drinks. And D'Angelo and his goons said that they would see Escobar and his people down the road. So then later on, in a separate segment, this is later in the night now, darkness has fallen, and they're in the parking lot. Now, I presume they were in the park. Now, maybe they were in the restaurant parking lot. I just assumed they were in the NXT parking lot because of what happened next. I have to go back now because maybe they were in the restaurant parking lot, but they were in the parking lot. Galante was all alone, and Escobar called him over. Escobar standing, leaning up against the car. He calls him over, and he's talking to him. You're a very important person to Tony D'Angelo. All of a sudden, the other members of Legado attack Galante. They threw him into their car, and they drove off. Yes, another kidnapping on NXT. Another kidnapping from the NXT parking lot, but again, I could be wrong about that. It could have been the parking lot at the restaurant. But regardless of exactly where it happened, another kidnapping here on NXT. You would think that by now they would have a police cruiser stationed out there to avoid this sort of thing. These parking lots here on NXT, they're like the fucking Bermuda Triangle. People just vanish without a trace. Nathan Fraser looked impressive in his 2.0 debut, another import from NXT UK, the former Ben Carter. Picking up a win over Grayson Waller. Wade Barrett noted on commentary that Fraser was a student of Seth Rollins, which is true. Rollins was a mentor of his at his Black and Brave Wrestling Academy. When Carter was learning how to work. But he's very impressive. I thought this was a good first match for him. It was good to see him pick up the win against Waller. Clearly, they see big things in Grayson Waller. So the fact they put Ben Carter over on him is good for Carter, although there was some distraction involved from Andre Chase and the Chase University crew. I don't know if Fraser is going to be associated with them or not, but anyway, Fraser looked good. I was worried about the idea of Nikita Lyons and Lash Legend being back in the ring together after what I said, you know, when I talked about this on the podcast last week. What I saw from them in that singles match did not inspire a lot of confidence to want to see them back in the ring together again, but they did all right. This wasn't bad. It was Lyons and Cora Jade against Lash Legend and Natalya. You could see, if you watch Natty when she's in there, especially in this match, you watch Natty, you can hear her. She's playing ring general, calling spots, keeping things together, which is why they sent her in there to work with these women. Lyons hit the splits into the leg drop on Legend, and then Jade went up, came off with a top rope senton for the win, getting Cora heated up for the eventual singles match with Natty. We had the Creed Brothers against the Viking Raiders, picking up a win over the Vikings. Roddy with the dirty assist. They were having a great match. And Roderick Strong at the end comes from out of nowhere. The referee didn't see it. This jumping knee strike to one of the members of the Raiders who had their head sticking out through the ropes. And the Creeds didn't see it either. They picked up the win. After the match, when they showed the replay of the end of the match up on the screen, they were not happy with Roddy. They didn't want his help, and Roddy tried to explain to them a win is a win. But already you're seeing the fracture in the ranks of what's left of Diamond Mine. This was a really good match. Nobody cared about the Viking Raiders. We've seen people come back from the main roster to NXT. We saw it with Natty, and we saw it with Dolph Ziggler. Now think of Natty and Dolph Ziggler on the main roster. They've been there for so long. They come out, they're not getting these kinds of reactions anymore, but they walked into the NXT, you know, the Nickelodeon Dome there for fucking 2.0. They come in there and they get this great reaction, and for Natty, it's welcome back. And for Dolph, it's like whatever they chanted for Dolph. And the Viking Raiders come out and they go, whatever. What has happened to War Machine? People used to go nuts for these guys. And now nobody cares. So we have Bron Breakker against Joe Gacy. I think I'm thinking of the Netflix documentary. Joe Gacy, challenging for the NXT Championship. The best thing about Gacy, honestly, is his theme music. It grows on me the more that I listen to it. It was cool to see Bron Breakker out there wearing what Vic Joseph told us was the same singlet that his father, Rick Steiner, who they are now openly, now that the Hall of Fame is coming on, they can openly acknowledge that he's the son of Rick Steiner. He's still Bron Breakker, but now at least they're allowed to mention that he's the son of Rick Steiner. But he mentioned that the singlet that Braun was wearing is the same singlet that Rick Steiner wore on the very first episode of Monday Night Raw in 1993. The Steiner brothers did wrestle on the very first Raw in 1993, but that was most definitely not the singlet that Rick Steiner was wearing in that match. Because I'm a wrestling nerd and I have to check these things, of course I did. Now, he did wear that same style of singlet at one of the WCW Clash of the Champions shows. It was the Steiners against Vader and Mr. Hughes, which is a fun little 10-minute match, by the way, for those who have never seen it. You're going to see Mr. Hughes take some bumps in that match that you wouldn't expect Mr. Hughes to be taking. But he wore the same kind of singlet in that match. It was a different color. So again, not the same singlet. I don't know why they had... Is it just quality control? Do they just make shit up? I would love to... Maybe somebody legitimately had a brain fart and thought... Maybe Braun said that to them and Braun was mistaken. I don't know. But anyway, that wasn't true. I do like that it had numbers all over it. There were just random numbers all over the singlet. It's like Steiner meth, years before Scott ever cut that promo. Outside of one ugly belly-to-belly that Gacy did not take very well from Breaker, we got to see more in this one match of what Joe Gacy can do in the ring than any other match I think I've seen him in up to this point on NXT. I'm not counting his independent work and his CZW work, but just in terms of this character in NXT, you know, he had his working shoes on in this match. The match itself was fine. As a main event, I thought it was average. There were a couple of other matches on the show that were much better than this. Breaker won with a spear, and I was hoping that this would be it for this. But then two druids climbed up on the apron behind Breaker, who didn't see them, and that's where the show went off the air. And then on YouTube, they posted an exclusive post-match video. The druids laid out Braun Breaker with a chair shot to the back. They pulled out this specially made gurney from under the ring that had barbed wire on the sides of it. They placed him gently on the gurney, and they carried him to the back. You know, Gacy's, his character work is not bad, but him doing the Undertaker stuff, man, this is just, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So the North American title match and the Creeds against the Vikings, those were quality matches. If you didn't see it, if you're looking for some good wrestling to watch, first watch the Josh Alexander Ishii match from the Impact show last night. That was the best match all week. But those two matches on this show were the best two matches of the night. So with that, let's take some of your questions. We've been diving back into the mailbag questions here at the end of these shows. I love it. I love it. Feed me more. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Joseph from Port St. Lucie, Florida. It's a good place to be a Mets fan down there in Port St. Lucie. I've been to Clover Park for spring training. It's a nice little stadium. Joseph says he never misses a podcast. I was thinking about what you were saying on the show 2 weeks ago about WWE possibly splitting the titles again, which will probably happen at some point. Oh, it will happen at some point. Could you see WWE using a similar method that AEW used when getting the Impact title off Kenny Omega and having a distraction finish that leads to Cody taking the WWE title off of Roman Reigns? And maybe McIntyre causes the distraction, which gives their feud a little more heat and eventually leads to Reigns' first pinfall loss against McIntyre at the UK show. I would much rather have unified titles, but what I think doesn't matter. What do you think, and is it possible this is the way that they're going? I sure hope not. I think that would be awful. When Cody Rhodes eventually wins the championship, if he goes in there and he only wins the title off a distraction by somebody else to build to that match as the bigger match, that completely marginalizes Cody. Cody's story is big enough and good enough on its own to be its own standalone big moment. The idea that he would do it on a show in the next few months based off interference by Drew McIntyre to build to a much bigger match, I think would be a terrible idea. So no, I hope that doesn't happen. And when the day comes that Cody does win the title, it has to be the WWE title. For the story to work, either the titles have to still be unified or it has to be the WWE title specifically that he wins. Maybe it's against Roman Reigns. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's against somebody else. Maybe when the time comes, it's against Randy Orton or somebody. But that is not the way that I would do it. Dan from Niagara Falls, New York. I heard you're in favor of CM Punk winning the AEW World title from Adam Page and then following that with MJF winning the belt from Punk. I wanted to know your thoughts on a backup plan for MJF to win the championship from Hangman, only for Punk to win it from him, and then Darby Allin beats Punk for the title since Darby was the first person Punk had a match with in AEW. If not, maybe Darby Allin beats MJF instead. Also, when and who do you think Darby Allin should beat to win the championship? Since I think Darby's first world title win would make for a great moment in AEW. Darby, I think, should beat MJF for the title. Especially after the great match they had at Full Gear. That great match they had in November to open the show. You run that back this time for the championship with Darby going over. So if I had to pick a person who I think should be the one to take the belt from MJF, the other reason I love that idea, especially when I talk about this now out loud, is you've got two guys who are considered two of the young pillars of that company. And two of the originals, the AEW originals. Because eventually you do want to transition away from Punk and Danielson being the champion or the focal point. And for it to come down to two people like Darby and MJF, I think, would be, you know, ultimately what you want to build to if you're Tony Khan. We already know they could go in there and have a great match. So I would have Darby beat MJF for the title. And then take it one step further, and this is probably not going to happen, but I would then have Malakai Black beat Darby for the championship. I know Malakai is not being featured at all right now as a singles guy. It's just the whole House of Black thing. He's doing trios matches and tag matches. But I would like to see them get to a point. And again, now we're talking a year, year and a half. Who knows? Maybe 2 years from now. I'm not saying this is going to happen in the next 6 months, but I think Malakai then taking the title from Darby and getting a run as the champion is something I'd like to see. Julius from the Bronx. The Blackpool Combat Club has quickly become my favorite faction in wrestling. Can you say that their trios matches are as good or even better than the Shield six-man matches from 2013? What? No. Julius, what are you doing? No. First of all, the only trios matches we've seen them have are with lower level talent. We haven't even seen them in the ring against the House of Black or Death Triangle or Omega and the Bucks. Like, those are the big trios matches to see them in, and we haven't even gotten there yet. Ask me that question in 6 months or a year from now. I might have a different answer, but no, absolutely not. No. Dylan from Toronto. Bret Hart against Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13 is my all-time favorite match. I know the match is regarded as one of the best ever, but if they fought for the championship, would that have made it even better? The match between Undertaker and Sid was not that good. I mean, that's an understatement. And Bret did have the title only a few weeks prior to WrestleMania. Do you think the match could have been elevated even higher had it been for the title, or is it perfect as is? That was the real main event of WrestleMania that year. There was no way Undertaker and Sid were following Bret Hart and Steve Austin. Even Undertaker knew that. He told Bret the exact same thing. It should have been for the title, if for no other reason, because they were the two featured in that disputed finish to the Royal Rumble match. You know, that was your title feud right there. Once Shawn vacated and Bret got the belt back. I don't think it would have changed the match much, though. I don't think it would have added that much to it beyond what we got. You know, the match can't get any more classic than it already is. It's one of the greatest matches I've ever seen. And had Bret stayed, and the Montreal Screwjob never happened, maybe it would have been better for this not to be for the title. Now that I think about it, because I believe the plan for WrestleMania 14 would have had Bret dropping the championship to Steve Austin and finally doing the honors and putting him over, and because Austin never got a pinfall win over Bret. I think that would have happened at WrestleMania the following year. But the match didn't need the title. It probably should have been the title match, but it didn't need to be in order for it to work the way that it did. It wasn't about the championship. It was about the double turn at the end. David from Chicago, I had two questions for you. After seeing FTR's match, last week, I felt they did great wrestling each other. It had me wondering who will have a better singles career, Dax Harwood or Cash Wheeler? And also, buy or sell on the best event for a title shot, the Royal Rumble match, or the G1 climax? I don't think Dax Harwood or Cash Wheeler are going to have a singles career, so I think it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a moot thing, but if they were to go on to have singles careers, look, I think they would probably have comparable careers. They're not going to win any world titles, but could they go in there and be a TNT champion or an intercontinental level, you know, champion? Yes. But they're not going to get any higher than that. They're both very good wrestlers. I would probably go with Harwood myself, but they're very, you know, they're very similar. As far as the other one, buy or sell on the best event for a title shot, it's a hard one for me to answer. I grew up watching the Royal Rumble. The Royal Rumble is one of my favorite events, so I have an affinity for it. However, in terms of, if you just look at it as, okay, if you're a wrestler and you've got to go through hell on glass barefoot, right, to get to a championship match, what is the tougher road to take? It's much tougher to win the G1 than it is to win the Royal Rumble. The Royal Rumble is a one-night match, over-the-top rope elimination. You don't have to pin your opponent. You don't have to make them submit. If you could just become invisible and hang on long enough, you could eke out a win. And you can get your title match at WrestleMania. The G1 is very different. It's a round robin. Everybody is going to face each other. You've got to wrestle. It's a hard schedule. It's a hard style. Over a period of many weeks, it's far more impressive to win the G1 than it is to win the Royal Rumble. So I'm going to buy on the G1, and I'm going to sell on the Royal Rumble. But I enjoy them both. Daniel from Hamburg, Germany. Buy or sell on the better match? The Shield against Team Hell No in Ryback at TLC 2012, or the Shield against Evolution at Payback 2014? I would buy on the Shield against Team Hell No and Cryback, and I would sell on the Shield against Evolution. Both great matches, 4 stars and above, but I enjoyed the TLC match more. Part of that may be the fact I was there live for it. I wasn't there live for the Payback match. It was a lot of fun being in the building, though, for the TLC match. That was WWE's debut at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And I remember Ryback taking the Shield triple powerbomb that took him out of the match for like 10 minutes straight, which probably made the match better than it would have been otherwise, right? They powerbombed Ryback, they got him out of the way, and the match went on from there. But everybody played their part well. The Shield was awesome, and that was their first match together. From the very first trios match they had together as a unit, the Shield were just fucking on point. Fantastic. I've said before, they and Daniel Bryan both in the ring when it came to Monday Night Raw carried that company, carried that brand all throughout 2013 into the beginning of 2014. If any of them or, you know, all of them go down with injuries or whatever, I mean, I don't know what that year looks like. And this was their first match together and they knocked it out of the park. It was a fantastic match. And Brian from Rapid City, South Dakota, buy or sell on which Undertaker WrestleMania loss you think was the worst match? The one against Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 30 or the one against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33? The significance of the streak ending really hides how awful that Brock match was after Undertaker got his concussion. I agree. It was a very slow, very boring match. I am going to buy on the WrestleMania 30 match, though. And I'm going to sell on the Orlando match. And I was there for both of them. I was actually in the stadium for both of them. And so I remember the reaction to both of those matches and how I was not the only one there live that night who felt this way. The people just weren't into it because of how slow and plodding and boring it was. And Undertaker hates watching the WrestleMania 33 match back. He thinks it was awful. He had no business being in the ring. He says he looked like a bloated Elvis out there. He didn't look great. And it was painful to watch that spot towards the end where the idea was they were going to do the reverse tombstone. And he fell down. And he tried to make up for it and have Roman pick him back up. And he fell down again. And that was the moment in the match I kind of put my head in my hands and I was embarrassed for him watching that. And if I was embarrassed for him, imagine how he felt as somebody who takes pride in his work. And I mean, just you watch the documentary on the network that they did, and he could barely stomach watching the match back because he realizes how awful it was. Physically, he had no business. He was hurting. He had no business being in the ring that night. And he thought that might be it. And he feels really bad that he couldn't give Roman Reigns the quality match he wanted to give Roman. He felt more bad about that than anything else. As bad as that match was, and disappointing and underwhelming as that match was, and you could say the same thing about the New Orleans match, but that you still had the significance of the finish. And I can't just ignore that. That match was entirely about that finish and the reaction to the finish. I'll never go to another wrestling show as long as I live, I don't believe, and will be part of something like that again. The shock that the crowd was in, the disbelief that people had and thinking it was a botch. Oh my God, they didn't mean for that to happen. What just happened? I can't believe it. And then you had other people who were celebrating and you had me who was laughing. I mean, it was weird, but it was fun, you know, to be part of something like that. At least with that match, it was a significant finish. The WrestleMania 33 thing was just sad. There was nothing redeeming about that match at all. And that was the main event. That's part of what made it worse. They ended the show with that. At least the Undertaker-Brock match, that wasn't what they ended the show with. So I got to buy on that one and sell on the Orlando one. That was also the WrestleMania that I think all of us, me and my whole crew, we started to have second thoughts about how much longer we're going to be going to these WrestleManias, because that was the longest one that we had ever been to. I mean, we were sitting out there for like 7 hours. And we went to 34. It was in New Orleans. That was a lot of fun. 35 wasn't so fun. And if the pandemic didn't happen, we wouldn't have been at 36 anyway. I think that was the end of our WrestleMania days, at least until they go back to New Orleans or Las Vegas. And then we'll have to have that conversation. But anyway, if you have questions for the mailbag, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I want to hear from you guys. And you never know when your question may be answered here live on the air. I'm going to be live on YouTube tonight. I can tell you that as soon as WrestleMania Backlash is over, our first of two pay-per-views here in the month of May, one for WWE, one that we end the month with for AEW in a few weeks. That'll be Double or Nothing. I'm going to go out on a limb here if I had to make a prediction. I know I'm really taking a chance by saying this, but I'm going to say the Double or Nothing is going to blow this show tonight out of the water. I would love to be wrong. Sometimes it's the shows that you look at and you're just sort of indifferent to that end up surprising you. There is the potential for there to be some really good matches on the card tonight. So fingers crossed on that. But I'm going to be live afterwards, so join me then. Follow me on Twitter. You can vote in the poll when the show is over, @Solomonster. And of course, I will be back with you next Sunday. That's going to be episode 756 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here. 15 years, you guys have been tuning in. 15 years is a very long time. 15 years, this train don't stop. And I will see you guys back here for more Sound Off later tonight on YouTube. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Everybody has to have something at the beginning of their theme. Drew McIntyre has the sword sound. Ricochet has the pew 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 pew. Moss has joke 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 joke. Boy, we've come a long way from the glass shatter. Do you smell what The Rock is cooking? Holy shit, what has happened to wrestling? What has happened to this fucking company? How did we get from that to this? This show is a joke 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 joke.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster.
Solo Monster sounds off.